Lecture 1 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, The Apocalypse of St. John. Lecture 1 is given in Nuremberg on the 18th of June, 1908. During the next 2 days, we shall concern ourselves with a very significant, very profound anthroposophical subject. Before beginning our studies, let me express my great satisfaction that we can place before friends from so many parts of Germany and indeed Europe some considerations on this deep and important subject. Especially do I express it to our dear friends in Nuremberg, who, for their part, are certainly not less happy than the speaker to cultivate anthroposophical life here in this city for a relatively longer period, together with our friends from elsewhere. There has always been in this city a most earnest search for the knowledge of great spiritual truths and a deep understanding of anthroposophical life, of the true anthroposophical attitude toward life. This kind of life, which is only understood when our anthroposophical teachings are not merely a theoretical interest, but something which spiritualizes, kindles, and uplifts our inmost life right into the depths of our soul, links us in closer bonds with our fellow men and with the whole world. It means much to man to feel that everything he sees externally in the sense world, in visible sense existence, can appear as external physiognomy of an underlying invisible supersensible existence. The world and all it contains will at length become, to one who applies anthroposophy to life, more and more an external countenance of divine spiritual realities. And, when he observes the visible world around him, it will be to him as if he penetrated from the features of a person's face to his heart and soul. All that he sees externally, the mountains and rocks, the plant mantle of the earth, the animals and human beings, human activities, everything in the world surrounding him, will be to him the countenance, the facial expression of a divine spiritual existence lying behind it. From this mode of observation, new life rises up within him and permeates him, and a different, a noble enthusiasm fires all that he wishes to undertake. Let me give you a small symptomatic example I recently experienced on one of my lecture tours, showing how significant world history is when looked upon as an expression of divine spiritual working, and how it can speak to us in a new language. A few weeks ago in Scandinavia, I noticed that in the entire life of Northern Europe, there is still an echo of that ancient period of the Norse world, when all spiritual life was permeated by consciousness of the beings that stand behind the gods of Northern mythology. One might say that in those countries, one may hear the echoes everywhere of what the initiates of the Druid and Draughton mysteries imparted to their pupils as old Norse spiritual life. One becomes aware of the magic breath of that spirit life pervading the North. One sees something like the expression of beautiful karmic connections. One feels oneself placed, as was my privilege in Uppsala, in the midst of all this, when one sees before one the first Gothic translation of the Bible, the Codex Argenteus of Ulfilas. It came to Uppsala through karmic complications of a strange kind. Previously it had been in Prague. In the Swedish War it was taken as booty and brought to Uppsala. And there now lies a token of what permeates those who can look a little more deeply into the nature of the ancient mysteries. The mysteries within the ancient European cultures, in which pupils were taught how to penetrate into the spiritual world, were all pervaded and permeated by a remarkable common characteristic, which could be felt more deeply by those who received initiation in those ancient times. A ripple of tragedy ran through their hearts when it was made clear to them that although they were, indeed, able to glimpse the secrets of existence, nevertheless something would appear in the future which would be like a perfect solution of the riddle. They were shown again and again that a higher light was to ray into the knowledge which could be given in the ancient mysteries. We may say that all these mysteries contain a prophetic indication of what was to come about in the future, namely, the appearance of Christ Jesus. The undertone, the attitude of expectation, the mood of prophecy, lay in the nature of the Northern Mysteries. The statement I shall now make must not be pressed too far, nor outlined too sharply in thought. It is only intended to express symptomatically the deeper underlying truth. In the legend of Siegfried, which has remained like a last page out of the traditions of the old Germanic mysteries, there is something secretly present of that mood. When we are shown that Siegfried is really the representative of the ancient Nordic initiation, that on the spot where he is vulnerable there lies a leaf, that this spot is on his back, then one who is able to sense such a thing symptomatically feels that is the spot on the human being where something different will rest when such injury as the initiates of the ancient Nordic mysteries could experience can no longer touch him. This spot the cross shall cover. There the cross of Christ Jesus shall rest. It did not yet rest there for the initiates of the ancient Nordic mysteries. In the old mysteries of the Germanic peoples, this is indicated in the legend of Siegfried. Thus, even here, is symptomatically indicated how the ancient initiations of the Druids and Drotten should be thought of as harmonizing with the Christian mysteries. The place of the first Gothic translation of the Bible in the northern world reminds one of this like a facial expression, and the fact that it is like a karmic chain of events may also be symbolized for you by the circumstance that 11 leaves were once stolen from this Codex Argenteus, and that the one who later on possessed them felt such qualms of conscience that he would not keep these 11 leaves and so return them. As already said, these things ought not to be pressed too far, but they may be given as figurative illustrations of those karmic circumstances which come to physiognomical expression in the placing, in the northern world, of the first Gothic translation of the Bible. And just as in the case of this historical event, so will everything which meets us in life, great or small, also be deepened and irradiated with a new light to the anthroposophical outlook, which sees everything physically perceptible as the facial expression of supersensible spirit. May we, during this course of lectures, be filled with the conviction that this is the case. And may the spirit and feelings which are to fill our hearts and minds during this series of 12 lectures on the Apocalypse proceed from this conviction. In this frame of mind, let us approach these lectures which will take as their starting point the most profound document of Christianity, the Apocalypse of John. The deepest truths of Christianity can be considered entirely naturally in connection with this document, for it contains nothing less than a great part of the mysteries of Christianity, that is, the profoundest part of what may be described as esoteric Christianity. It is therefore not to be wondered at that of all Christian documents, this one has been most misunderstood. Almost from the beginning of the spiritual movement of Christianity, it has been misunderstood by all who were not really Christian initiates. And it has always been misunderstood at various times, according to the prevailing thought and disposition of those times. It has been misunderstood by the times which, one might say, have thought in a spiritually materialistic way, by times that have forced great religious movements into one-sided fanatical party affairs, and it has been misunderstood in modern times by those who in the grossest and most sense-bound materialism believe themselves able to solve the riddle of the universe. The high spiritual truths proclaimed at the starting point of Christianity, which those who were capable of understanding were brought to contemplate, are hinted at, as far as is possible, in writing in the Apocalypse of John, the so-called canonical apocalypse. But even in the early days of Christianity, those in the more exoteric stream were little inclined to understand the deep spirituality of esoteric Christianity. Thus, in the very early days of Christianity, the idea came into the exoteric stream that things which, in the world's evolution, first take place in the spiritual worlds, that such purely spiritual proceedings ought to take place externally in material life. And so it came about that while the writer of the Apocalypse expressed in his work the results of his Christian initiation, others only understood it exoterically, and their opinion was that what the great seer saw, what the initiate knows can be seen spiritually, taking place over thousands of years, must happen in the very near future, in external life, and be visible to the senses. They imagined that the writer was indicating something like a speedy return of Christ Jesus, a descent from the physical clouds. When this failed to occur, they simply extended the period and said, "With the advent of Christ Jesus, a new period has begun, for the earth, in contrast to the old religious teachings, but," parenthesis, this again was understood materialistically, close parenthesis, "after 1,000 years, the next events described in the Apocalypse will take place in the physical world." Thus it came about that when the year A.D. 1000 was dawning, many people actually expected the coming of some power hostile to Christianity. An Antichrist was to appear in the sense world. As this again did not occur, the period was further extended. But at the same time, the whole prediction of the Apocalypse was elevated to a kind of symbolism, whereas the crass, exoteric approach had represented the prophecy more literally. With the advent of a materialistic world conception, these things were enveloped in a certain symbolism. External events were invested with a symbolic significance. Thus, in the 12th century, Joachim of Florus, who died at the beginning of the 13th century, gave a notable explanation of this mysterious document of Christianity. It was his opinion that Christianity contained a deep spiritual power, that this power would have to expand more and more, but that external Christianity has always given this esoteric Christianity an external interpretation. Many people adopted this man's view that the papal church, this externalization of the spirituality of Christianity, was something hostile and anti-Christian. And this attitude was particularly fostered in the following centuries through the way certain orders attached higher value to the spiritual aspect of Christianity, the element of spiritual fervor. Thus, Joachim of Florus found followers among the Franciscans, and these looked upon the Pope as the symbol of Antichrist. Then, in the age of Protestantism, this conception passed over to those who looked upon the Roman Church as an apostate of Christianity, and Protestantism as its salvation. More than ever, they considered the Pope to be the symbol of the Antichrist, and the Pope retaliated by calling Luther the Antichrist. Thus the Apocalypse was understood in such a way that each party drew it into the service of its own view, its own opinion. Each regarded the other as Antichrist and identified itself with true Christianity. This continued into modern times, when modern materialism developed, with which, for grossness, even the materialism I described as belonging to the early centuries of Christianity cannot be compared. For at that time, spiritual faith and a certain spiritual comprehension still existed. Men were unable to understand only because they had no initiates among them. A certain spiritual sense was there, For although it was crudely imagined that a being would descend in a cloud, there still belonged to it a spiritual faith. A spiritual life such as this was no longer possible with the crass materialism of the 19th century. The thoughts of a genuine materialist of the 19th century regarding the apocalypse can be described somewhat as follows. No man can see into the future, for I myself cannot. No one can see anything more than I can see. To say that there are initiates is an old superstition. Such persons do not exist. What I know is the norm. I can scarcely see what will happen in the next 10 years. Therefore no man can say anything about what is to happen over thousands of years. Consequently, whoever wrote the Apocalypse, if he is to be taken as an honest man, must have been describing something which he had already seen, for I only know what has already taken place, and what I can discover from documents. Therefore the writer of the Apocalypse could see nothing more either. What, therefore, according to this, can he relate? Only what had happened up to his time. Thus it is obvious that the events of the Apocalypse, the conflicts between the good, wise, and beautiful world and the ugly, foolish, and evil world, this dramatic contrast, is only intended to represent what the author had himself experienced, what had already taken place. The modern materialist speaks in this way. It is his opinion that the writer of the Apocalypse describes things as he himself does. What, then, was the most dreadful thing to a Christian of the first century? It was the beast which rebelled against the spiritual power of Christianity, against the true Christianity. Unfortunately, the few people who perceived that there was something behind this did not know how to interpret it correctly. In certain esoteric schools, there was a kind of writing in numbers. Certain words which it was not wished to impart in ordinary writing were expressed by figures. And, like much else, some of the deep secrets of the Apocalypse were hidden in numbers, particularly that dramatic event in the number 666. It was known that numbers were to be dealt with in a particular way, especially when such a distinct indication is given as in the words, "Here is wisdom. The number of the beast is 666. When such an indication was given, it was known that the figures must be replaced by certain letters in order to ascertain what was intended. Now those who had heard something, and yet really knew nothing, came to the conclusion in their materialistic conception that when letters were substituted for the number 666, the word Nero, or Caesar Nero, resulted. And nowadays, in a large part of the literature dealing with the deciphering of the Apocalypse, you may read, "Formerly people were so foolish that they imagined all sorts of things in connection with this passage. But the problem is now solved. We now know that nothing else is meant than Nero, Caesar Nero." It is clear that the Apocalypse must have been written at a time when Nero had already lived, and the writer wished to say, by all this, that the Antichrist had appeared in Nero, and that what is contained in this dramatic element is an enhancement of what had preceded it. We need now only investigate what happened immediately before, and we shall discover what the writer of the Apocalypse really wished to describe. It is reported that earthquakes took place in Asia Minor, when the struggle between Nero and Christianity was raging. Therefore it was to these earthquakes that the writer was referring in the opening of the seals and the sounding of the trumpets. He also mentions plagues of locusts. Quite correct. We know from history that at the time of the persecution of the Christians by Nero, there were plagues of locusts. He was, therefore, speaking of these. Thus the 19th century has come to materialize the profoundest document of Christianity so far as to see nothing in it but the description of what may be found by a mere materialistic observation of the world. I have only mentioned this in order to point out how fundamentally this deepest and most important document of esoteric Christianity has been misunderstood. I shall postpone to the last lectures what is to be said about the historical part of the Apocalypse, when we shall have understood what is contained in the Apocalypse itself. To those who have found their way into Anthroposophy, to some extent, there can be no doubt that even the introductory words of the Apocalypse show us what it is intended to be. We need only remember that it says that he from whom the contents of the Apocalypse proceeded was placed in an island solitude, which had always been surrounded by a kind of sacred atmosphere, one of the ancient places of the mysteries. And when we are told that the author was in the Spirit, and that in the Spirit he perceives what he gives us, it may indicate to us that the contents of the Apocalypse originate from a higher state of consciousness, to which a person may attain through the development of his inner creative capacity of soul, through initiation. In the so-called secret revelation of John is contained what cannot be seen or heard in the sense world, what cannot be perceived with external senses, and it is given in the way in which it can be imparted to the world through Christianity. In the Apocalypse of John we have, therefore, the description of an initiation, a Christian initiation. We need only briefly recall what initiation is. We shall, of course, go more and more deeply into the question of what takes place in initiation and how initiation is related to the contents of the Apocalypse. But to begin with, we will only draw something like a rough pencil sketch and paint in the details later. Initiation is the development of the powers and capacities slumbering in every soul. If we wish to have an idea of the manner in which it really takes place, we must clearly bear in mind what the consciousness of the present normal man is. We shall then also recognize in what way the consciousness of the initiate differs from that of the ordinary man of today. What is, then, the consciousness of the normal human being like? It is a changing one. Two entirely different states of consciousness alternate, that of wakefulness during the day and that during sleep at night. Our waking day consciousness consists in our perceiving sense objects around us and connecting them by means of concepts, which can only be formed with the aid of a tool belonging to the sense world, namely the human brain. Then, each night, the astral body and the ego withdraw from the lower principles of the human being, the physical and etheric bodies, and therewith the sense objects around man sink into the darkness. And not only this, for until reawakening, total unconsciousness prevails. Darkness spreads around man. For the human astral body today, under normal conditions, is so organized that it is unable of itself to perceive what surrounds it. It must have tools. These tools are the physical senses. Therefore, in the morning, it must submerge itself in the physical body and make use of the sense organs. Why does the astral body see nothing when during sleep at night it is in the spirit world? Why does it not perceive? For the same reason that a physical body without eyes or ears could experience neither physical colors nor physical sounds. The astral body has no organs with which to perceive in the astral world. In primeval times, the physical body was in the same position. It, too, did not yet possess what later was molded into it as ears and eyes. The external elements and forces chiseled out and formed the eyes and ears, and thus this world was revealed to man, a world which was previously hidden from him. Let us imagine that the astral body, which is now in the position in which the physical body was formerly, could be so treated that organs could be built into it in the same way that the sunlight molded the physical eyes and the world of sound, the physical ears, in the soft substance of the physical human body. Let us imagine that we could mold organs in the malleable substance of the astral body. Then the astral body would be in the same condition as the present physical body. It is a question of molding the organs of perception for the supersensible world into this astral body, as a sculptor molds his clay. This is the first thing. If a man wishes to become a seer, his astral body must be treated as a sculptor treats a piece of clay. Organs must be worked into it. This was, in fact, what was always done in the schools of initiation and in the mysteries. The organs were molded in the astral body. In what does the activity consist by means of which it is possible for the astral body to have organs molded into it? It might be thought that a person must first have the body in front of him before he can work the organs into it. He might say, if I could take out the astral body and have it in front of me, I could then mold the organs into it. That would not be the right way, then Steiner says, that would not be the right way, and above all, it is not the way for modern initiation. Certainly, an initiate who is able to live in the spiritual worlds could mold the organs like a sculptor, when during the night the astral body is outside. But that would entail doing something of which the person concerned is not conscious. It would mean interfering in his sphere of freedom with the exclusion of his consciousness. We shall see why this has not been allowed to happen for a long time past, and particularly not in the present time. For this reason, even in esoteric schools such as the Pythagorean or Old Egyptian, everything had to be avoided whereby the initiates would work from outside upon the astral body, which was taken out of the physical and etheric bodies of the neophyte. This had to be avoided from the very outset. The first step toward initiation had to be undertaken with man in the ordinary physical world, in the same world where he perceives with his physical senses. But how can this be done? For it is exactly through physical perception, coming into earthly evolution, that a veil was drawn over the spiritual world formerly perceived by man, although his consciousness was dull. How can one work with the physical world upon the astral body? Here it is necessary that we should consider what happens with regard to our ordinary daytime sense perceptions. What happens when man perceives during the day? Think of your daily life. Follow it step by step. At every step, the impressions of the outer world press in upon you. You perceive them. You see, hear, smell, and so on. When you are doing your work, impressions storm in upon you all day long, and you work upon these impressions with your intellect. The poet, who is not an inspired poet, permeates them with his imagination. All this is true, but it cannot, to begin with, lead man to the consciousness of the supersensible spiritual, which lies behind the sensible and material. Why does it not come to his consciousness? Because all this activity which man exercises with respect to the surrounding world does not correspond with the essential nature of the human astral body as it exists today. When, in the primeval past, the astral body proper to man saw the pictures of the astral perceptions rise up, those pictures of joy and sorrow, of sympathy and antipathy, inner spiritual impulses were present, causing something to rise in man which formed organs. These were killed when man attained the ability to allow all the influences from outside to stream in upon him. And at the present time, it is impossible for anything to remain in the astral body from all the impressions received during the day which could mold or shape it. The process of perception is as follows. All day long we are subjected to the impressions of the external world. These work through the physical senses upon the etheric and astral bodies until the ego becomes conscious of them. The result of what affects the physical body is expressed in the astral body. When the eyes receive impressions of light, these influence the etheric and astral bodies, and the ego becomes conscious of them. So, too, with the impressions made upon the ears and other senses. Thus the whole of one's daily life affects the astral body throughout the day. The astral body is continually active under the influence of the outer world. Then, in the evening, it withdraws from the physical body. It now has no power in itself to become conscious of the impressions in its present environment. The ancient perceptive forces of the distant past were killed with the first perception of the present sense world. During the night it has no power, because the entire life of the day is not suited to leaving anything in the astral body which could work formatively upon it. All the things you see around you produce effects as far as into the astral body. But what then takes place is unable to create forms capable of becoming astral organs. It must be the first step of initiation to allow a person to do something during the life of the day, to allow something to play into his soul, which continues during the night when the astral body is withdrawn from the physical and etheric bodies. Imagine that, speaking pictorially, something is given to a person while he is fully conscious, which he has to do, which he has to allow to happen, and which is so chosen, so constructed, that it does not cease working when the day is over. Imagine this activity as a sound, which continues when the astral body is withdrawn. This resounding would then constitute the force which works to mold the astral body, as at one time external forces have worked upon the physical body. This was always the first step of initiation, to give a person something to do during the life of the day, which has an after effect in the life of the night. What is called meditation, concentration, and other exercises which a person undertakes during his daily life are nothing but activities of the soul, the effects of which do not die away when the astral body withdraws, but which reverberate, and then in the night become constructive forces in the astral body. This is called the purification of the astral body, purification from all that is unnatural to it. This was the first step, which was also called catharsis, purification. It did not yet constitute activity in supersensible worlds. It consisted in exercises of the soul, which the pupil performed during the day as a training of the soul. It consisted in adopting certain forms of life, certain attitudes to life, a certain way of treating life, so that it could continue to sound. And this worked upon the astral body until it had been transformed, until organs had developed in it. When the pupil had progressed so far that these organs had developed in the astral body, the next thing was that everything which had been formed there should be imprinted in the etheric body. Just as the characters on a seal are imprinted in sealing wax, so must everything which has been formed in the astral body be imprinted in the etheric body. This imprinting is the next stage of initiation. It was called illumination, for it brought with it an important stage in initiation. A spiritual world then appeared around the pupil, just as formerly the sense world was around him. This stage is also characterized by the fact that the events of the outer spiritual world do not express themselves as physical objects do, but in pictures. At this stage of illumination, the spiritual world at first expresses itself in pictures. The pupil sees pictures. Think of the ancient initiate I referred to yesterday, who saw the group soul of a people. When he had progressed to this stage, he at first saw this group soul in pictures. Imagine an initiate such as Ezekiel, who, when his illumination began, became aware of spiritual beings as folk souls, group souls. He felt himself in their midst. He saw group souls in the form of four symbolic beasts. So to begin with, the spiritual world appeared to the pupil in significant pictures. That was the first stage. Then followed a further penetration into the etheric body. What at first was present like the impression of a seal was followed by a further penetration into the etheric body. Then there began to be added to the pictures what was known as the music of the spheres. The higher spiritual world is perceived as sound. The higher initiate, having through illumination perceived the spiritual world in pictures, begins spiritually to listen to those sounds which are perceptible to the spiritual ear. Then he comes to the later transformation of the etheric body, and afterward, in a still higher sphere, something else approaches him. If, for example, there is a screen here, and behind it a man is speaking whom you cannot see, yet you may hear sounds, it is somewhat similar with the spiritual world. At first it appears in pictures, then sounds are heard, and then the last veil falls away, as if we were to take away the screen behind which the man is standing and speaking. We see the man himself. We see the spiritual world itself, the beings of the spiritual world. First we perceive the pictures, then the sounds, then the beings, and lastly the life of these beings. It is indeed only possible to give a hint of what exists as pictures in the so-called imaginative world by making use, as symbols, of pictures from the sense world. One can only give an idea of the harmony of the spheres by comparing it with ordinary music. Now, what may be compared with the impressions of the beings at the third stage? It is comparable alone with what today constitutes the inmost being of man, his acting in accordance with the divine universal will. If the pupil works according to the will of the spiritual beings who are helping the world onward, the being within him will then become similar to these beings, and he will perceive in this sphere. He perceives that the element within him, which opposes the evolution of the world, which retards its progress, is something which must be thrown off in this world, something which must fall away like a last covering. Thus the pupil first perceives a world of pictures as a symbolic expression of the spiritual world, then a world of sphere harmony as a symbolic expression of a higher spiritual sphere, then a world of spiritual beings, of whom he can today only form an idea by comparing them with the depths of his own being, with what works within him in accordance with the good powers, or even in accordance with the evil spiritual forces. The neophyte passes through these stages, and they are faithfully portrayed in the Apocalypse of John. The start is made from the physical world. What is first to be said by means of the physical world is said in the seven letters. What we wish to do in physical culture, what we wish to say to those working in the physical world, we say in letters. For the word expressed in the letter can produce its effect in the sense world. The first stage provides the symbols which must be brought into relation with what they express in the spiritual world. After the seven letters comes the world of the seven seals, the world of pictures of the first stage of initiation. Then comes the world of the sphere harmonies, the world as it is perceived by those who can hear spiritually. It is represented in the seven trumpets. The next world, where the initiate perceives beings, is represented by those beings who appear at this stage and who cast off the vials of the forces opposed to the good. The opposite of the divine love is the divine wrath. The true form of the divine love, which carries the world forward, is perceived in this third sphere by those who, for the physical world, have cast off the seven vials of wrath. Thus the neophyte is led, step by step, upward into the spheres of initiation. In the seven letters of the Apocalypse of John, we have what belongs to the seven categories of the physical world. In the seven seals, what belongs to the astral world of imagination. In the seven trumpets, what belongs to the world of Devakan, above it. And in the seven vials of wrath, what must be cast aside if the pupil wishes to rise into what is spiritually the highest to be attained in our world, because this spiritually highest is still connected with our world. Today we wished to give merely a sketch of the outer structure of the Apocalypse of John, which serves to show that this is a book of initiation. In our next lecture, we shall begin to fill in this brief sketch. The end of Lecture 1 of the Apocalypse of St. John, Lectures by Rudolf Steiner.